Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Nau mai, haere mai. I'm John McDonald, kia ora, and welcome into the Hut Zone on Thursday the 29th of September. The Hut Zone is Wellington Access Radio's weekly look into the stories, history, people, poems and music that make the Hutt Valley community. Tonight we hear the introductory notes to Catherine Mansfield's last book, The Dove's Nest and Other Stories, thanks to Rob Marland of LibriVox Recordings. There's plenty of local history for you tonight. We hear more about musicians Wayne Mason's Upper Hutt Memories from 2016, courtesy of Upper Hutt Libraries. And we hear more about the post-war school history of Trentham's Marlene Cockcroft, who talks about going to a girls' grammar school in Oldham, England. And there is local music from Bruce Aiken, bringing us happiness, and Bernie Brown sings The Bishop and the Tohunga. But let's start with our weekly dose of local poetry, this week from Eastbourne's Emmanuel E. Garcia.
The Forgotten Book. Imagine my flight, the toppled statuary skyward gazing. Had I stopped to kiss her cheeks, the huntress quiet, mortal as the dew, I would have colder grown. The eye caught, her throat glistened ever. It was late when I pulled the charts at home, shrapnel on the table, a gift of shattered cups. I nodded to my masks, spread the fading maps, followed the lines, traced the many absent mysteries. The absorbing earth, a ferocious firmament, became my balm in the hues of dawn. In my forgotten book, I heard the missing voice, more faint and fainter, far more beautiful.
And that was The Forgotten Book by Emmanuel E. Garcia. Okay, let's hear more memories in the penultimate episode from a founding member of the Formula Band, Wayne Mason. Upper Hutt City Library's Karen Wilton talked to Wayne in 2016 for an audio archive series marking Upper Hutt City's 50th birthday celebrations.
And people used to take record players to the beach, those ones, the portable ones, battery operated, with 45 singles, and I don't know how they operate in the sand.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you don't want to get sand on
them. Yeah, I know one of the guitars we had got backed over by a car on the beach, stuff like that. The one that I actually wrote Nature on had that done to it. It was a nylon string acoustic, was bent like a half bow. It had been straightened up after someone had sort of tried to back over it, and it was... That was a state of instruments, pretty rough and ready. Yeah.
Maybe I should ask you about writing Nature.
Written at 710 Ferguson Drive, which I still, when I came past today, I looked at
the
house.
710 Ferguson
Drive. Yeah.
Whose place was that?
That was Olivia's place, Olivia Castro's place. And I stayed there after I came back from England for about 3 or 4 months, well, before I left again, went back to England, before I came back and got married. Yeah, so I was happened to be there, staying there in about August, September, after we got back from England, thinking about writing. Ellie and me had been writing all those songs together for a year or so, and I thought it'd be quite nice to write something by myself. So that was a more personalised type of thing. So I wrote it there one morning, really, just all in one go, really. It was on the guitar that was bent, and it was that, and that's why it's in a funny key on the record, because it's actually played on A flat minor, which is because the guitar couldn't tune up any further than that without bending too much, so the tension wasn't. So yeah, we decided to play. We all tuned down and did it in A flat minor, which was a terrible key if you happen to have a non-tuned flat guitar. So it's, I play it in A minor now, up where, you know, where normal guitars play. But and it, yeah, it was, it just all the words sort of came, and their place was it's denuded with trees now, but way back then it was just covered in with big trees and stuff. It's all been taken out, and it was a really nice sort of environment.
Was it autumn?
It would have been, well, no, it would have been spring after winter. Yeah, it's through falling leaves in spring. No, well, that was my poetic license. I just made the whole thing up. When it came to the chorus, I couldn't write a chorus for it, so I couldn't. I kept getting sounding like I had too many words, so I just ended up doing doo-doo-dee-dees and doo-doos, and that was fine. And, you know, as I often said, it wasn't out of the question to do that stuff in pop songs at that time. La-las, doo-doos, dee-dees are okay. I haven't used many since. But
maybe the time has passed.
Yeah, the time has passed. When I write stuff now, it hasn't got this stuff on it.
So being in a band as a teenager, like, what kind of impact did that have on... Were your parents supportive?
No. No, they weren't at all. No. Well, not when they... No, that was what the whole question was about, really. It was about the fact that you had to have a job, a career, money, security, the usual standard stuff. So being a musician was completely off the register. They weren't... When I told them I'd got into the school band very excitedly, I came home from school and said, I got in the band. She said, yes, Wayne, but that's, you know, it's okay to have a hobby in music, but it's like schoolwork and other stuff is much more important. And as time went on and we became more and more involved in it, I think she could see the writing on the wall like that. So she would, I think it's one of the reasons that they asked me to go up to Napier, not to stay in Upper Hutt, because they figured if I stayed there in Upper Hutt, I'd just end up doing music. So that big fight that we had was just over that thing. Of course, when we became well known, my mother did a good about face, that one, and she was more proud of the effort than she had been, and so she sort of came around to be a supporter, you know. So there you go.
And what about at school, like teachers and with other kids?
Oh, it was always huge kudos being in the school band. It's a big ego thing, yeah. Especially if you're okay. I mean, that's the hardest thing of performance, really, is that thing of feeling okay about yourself, being proud of what you do, and strutting your stuff, you know, and because people would like you for that. I don't know, you know, it's just one of those things. And you know, so you did get some status increase. Became well known in school. I did. Became more of a notorious as I went through school, I think, and from being invisible in the third form, by the time I left, I was trouble.
Really?
Oh, I was always trouble. I'm a very cheeky person, and always give lip to people or answer back with the last word. I was at assembly at here at our college. I was always trying to stay out of trouble. It was really funny because when I left school, and I was 65, and we were playing at a dance in Silverstream's, one of those dances in Silverstream Social Hall on the main road. One of the parents at the dance was Mr. Miller, who was the first assistant, who I had a very bad run in my entire time at secondary school. And now I left school and got a job, and I was still in the band. We're doing a gig, and someone had turned the lights off at the hall and then turned them on, was playing with the lights, because they only turned some of them off because they didn't want it totally dark. And someone had turned them on, and I'd made some comment, and this voice from the back of the hall yelled out, "Mason, that's enough cheek from you." And it was, you know, oh my God, you know, he's still there. It's like, yeah, that was, you know, my run-in was those sort of people who I didn't respect that much. It lasted after school.
what about girls? Like, were girls kind of impressed by guys that were in bands?
Yeah, yeah. It's how you get a girlfriend.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you have to dance. It's perfect. Speaking of men, girls, and they have to dance because you're playing. I swear it sometimes at musicians and musicians because they just don't want to dance. Yeah, but you dance when you play, but that's it has a certain you know, stuff to it, rock and roll, whatever. It musicians does. Are musicians.
It increases girls, surely, doesn't it?
Well, Olivia's musical tastes when we met. She was way... I mean, she had Leonard Cohen records and Fleetwood Mac records and other people that I'd never really heard about. And I had no records, and I was playing Everlasting Love on The Love Affair. I was doing something else in a pop band. She wasn't really that impressed. She thought we were quite twee as a band, because she was into the sort of blues and soul stuff, and we were playing pop music. So, yeah, I mean, that wasn't the thing that attracted her to me, my music, I don't think. She thought that we were very naff, I think. Sort of naff. Must have been something else that she... I remember, because her family, after we did Come With Me, I took the record round to her family's place to play it for them, and they all sit around and listen to it. And her mother, who was a teacher at Upper School, primary school, said, "Wayne, there's a grammatical error in it." And I went, "Really?" And she said, "Yeah, and there's a line in it which goes, nothing, the horizon looks much closer than it seems." And she said, "Nothing can look and seem at the same time. So actually, you've made a mistake." And I've never forgotten that. Every time I hear that record, I think of that. And I was so embarrassed. I thought, holy, you know, we've made a record which has got a grammatical error in it. I hope no one picks it up. And she's the only person that's ever mentioned that. But it actually is wrong. But that doesn't matter. It's perfect license. You can do that.
It's a song. I see what she means.
But yeah, you can, here I was. Yeah. I know. But they were quite critical. They would listen to it and went, "Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah." And then I tried to change my musical taste, because it obviously appeared that I was out of step with real music. So, yeah.
And you had a fan club from quite early age.
We had a huge fan club. It was Diane McKenzie used to do it. She used to run it like an empire, and we'd have to do submissions to it, you know. We'd write bits, everyone would take a turn of writing stuff for the newsletter. She used to sort of post it out. There was hundreds of people in it. And it was a really good supportive part of the business, really, of playing. It didn't last that long. It lasted probably a couple of years. And we were really popular.
Was that based here?
She was living in Taito, I think, or Nainai, somewhere down there. Yeah, based here. But when we went to England and stayed there, it was the end of it, obviously. Stopped relating to anything over there. We eventually broke up over there, so it was... And we've done a couple of things. We did a thing here in Harcourt Park, a reunion thing in 2002. And it was the first time in New Zealand we'd ever played Nature. Like, because we wrote it, never played it live, because we couldn't, because it was acoustic. But the PAs have got better, so we did that gig there, and that was great. That was a nice moment. And there's a couple of things on YouTube of that same gig, with us doing Otaki, I think, and something else, Turn Your Back on the Wind, I think, which is really cool. Someone filmed it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we did a... two gigs. We did one in 2010 in Civic Theatre Hall here. Like, I filmed it and played there for a 40 years of Nature thing. That about 500 people came to that. It's quite cool. And we did one in 2012 at the Viaduct Basin in Auckland for a festival up there. So that was the last time we played together. The original formula.
So same lineup.
Same lineup. Everyone's still alive.
Oh. Yeah. And of course, Nature got such a big boost again with the Birds recording it. What, yeah. Then with it being voted?
They did it in 91, I think, with Mutton Birds. And in 2002, the APRA ran that thing about asking writers to vote on the song they liked the most in their history of their music and what they'd done. So they asked the writers to vote it, and Nature came out as like the most preferred, sort of most popular song amongst writers, which is quite cool. It wasn't like a national vote amongst the people of New Zealand, but it was a writer's thing. I should make that an historical fact. I remember being in Upper Hutt here one day for something, and someone yelling out at me across, "Oh, that song's not the best song. It's something else. Yeah, what about, what about?" Because a lot of people went like that. So you get a bit of chip. But actually, it was writers that had voted for it, and his history always gets twisted. And so this is a piece of truth. The actual truth of that is that it's an APRA writers thing. Celebrate 75 years of APRA. They did that thing. It worked well in Australia, so I thought they'd try it here. And you got nothing for it. I went up to the Silver Scroll, and they announced the winner, and that was, I played it with the Mutton Birds, but it didn't get any money for it or anything, but got the supposed kudos from that particular thing.
My way slowly, talking aloud. sunlight filters through. I feel my head is bursting. So full of thoughts, I fall. What am I going to do? I need some thoughts that I
I'm John McDonald, and you're in the Hut Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM, and that was The Formula and their iconic song, Nature. And before that was lead singer Wayne Mason talking to Karen Wilton. Thank you to Upper Hutt City Library for the use of that interview. You can find the full collection of the 1960s history stories by Googling Recollect and Upper Hutt City Library. The final episode of Wayne Mason's story is next week. Okay, let's whip down the valley to Eastbourne and travel back in time to 1923 and hear the second part of the introduction to Catherine Mansfield's last book, written by her husband, John Middleton Murray.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Rob Marland. The Dove's Nest and Other Stories by Catherine Mansfield. Introductory note. Yet, a little later, her vision of the cause of her own dissatisfaction deepened, and she began to define it in terms of the insufficient clarity of her own spirit and of the incompleteness of her inward life, which were to become more and more familiar. Well, I must confess I have had an idle day. God knows why. All was to be written, but I just didn't write it. I thought I would, but I felt tired after tea and rested instead. Is it good or bad in me to behave so? I have a sense of guilt, but at the same time, I know that to rest is the very best thing I can do. And for some reason, there is a kind of booming in my head, which is horrid. But marks of earthly degradation still pursue me. I am not crystal clear. Above all else, I do still lack application. It's not right. There is so much to do, and I do so little. Look at the stories that wait and wait just at the threshold. Why don't I let them in? And their place would be taken by others who are lurking beyond, just out there, waiting for the chance. next day. Yet take this morning, for instance. I don't want to write anything. It's grey, it's heavy and dull, and short stories seem unreal and not worth doing. I don't want to write. I want to live. What does one mean by that? It's not too easy to say. But there you are. August 21. All this that I write, all that I am, is on the border of the sea. It's a kind of playing. I want to put all my force behind it, but somehow I cannot. And again in the autumn of the year, her incessant effort towards an inward purity, who but she would have dreamed that she lacked it, as a condition of soul essential to writing as she purposed to write, becomes still more manifest. October 16. Another radiant day. Jay is typing my last story, The Garden Party, which I finished on my birthday. It took me nearly a month to recover from At the Bay. I made at least 4 false starts, but I could not get away from the sound of the sea and Beryl fanning her hair at the window. These things would not die down. But now I am not at all sure about that story. It seems to me it's a little wispy, not what it might have been. The GP is better, but that is not good enough either. The last few days, what one notices more than anything is the blue. Blue sky, blue mountains, all is a heavenly blueness, and clouds of all kinds, wings, soft white clouds, almost hard little golden islands, great mock mountains. The gold deepens on the slopes. In fact, in sober fact, it is perfection. But the late evening is the time of times. Then, with that unearthly beauty before one, it's not hard to realise how far one has to go. To write something that will be worthy of that rising moon, that pale light. To be simple enough as one would be simple before God. November 21. Since then I have only written The Doll's House. A bad spell has been on me. I have begun 2 stories, but then told them and they felt betrayed. It's absolutely fatal to give way to this temptation. Today I begin to write, seriously, The Weak Heart, a story which fascinates me deeply. What I feel it needs so peculiarly is a very subtle variation of tense from the present to the past and back again, and softness, lightness, and the feeling that all is in bud, with a play of humour over the character of Roddy, and the feeling of the Thorndon baths, the wet, moist, oozy. No, I know how it must be done. May I be found worthy to do it. Lord, make me crystal clear for thy light to shine through. The 2 stories which she told, and then was forced to abandon, because they felt betrayed, were Honesty and All Serene. Of Weak Heart, as she subsequently called it, only fragments remain. There is the opening, copied in careful writing, a few hurriedly written sentences from the middle, themes, as it were, hastily noted, and then, obviously written at top speed and decipherable only with great difficulty, the end. The 2 following passages from her journal belong to the same months, October and November 1921, but they were written in another book, and one of them should be placed in point of time between the 2 previous entries. Catherine Mansfield's attempts at keeping a regular journal were intermittent. Nearly all the passages quoted here as from her journal were written on random pages of the little copybooks in which she composed her stories. In order to appreciate the first of the following passages fully, it should be remembered that it was written immediately after she had finished At the Bay. October 1921. I wonder why it should be so difficult to be humble. I do not think I am a good writer. I realise my faults better than anyone else could realise them. I know exactly when I fail. And yet, when I have finished a story and before I have begun another, I catch myself preening my feathers. It's disheartening. There seems to be some bad old pride in my heart, a root of it that puts out a thick shoot on the slightest provocation. This interferes very much with work. One can't be calm, clear, good, as one must be while it goes on. I look at the mountains, I try to pray, and I think of something clever. It's a kind of excitement within one which shouldn't be there. Calm yourself, clear yourself, and anything that I write in this mood will be no good. It will be full of sediment. If I were well, I would go off by myself somewhere and sit under a tree. One must learn, one must practice, to forget oneself. I can't tell the truth about Aunt Anne unless I am free to enter into her life without self-consciousness. Oh God, I am divided still. I am bad. I fail in my personal life. I lapse into impatience, temper, vanity, and so I fail as thy priest. Perhaps poetry will help. I have just thoroughly cleaned and attended to my fountain pen. If after this it leaks, then it is no gentleman. November 13, 1921. It is time I started a new journal. Come, my unseen, my unknown, let us talk together. Yes, for the last 2 weeks I have written scarcely anything. I have been idle. I have failed. Why? Many reasons. There has been a kind of confusion in my consciousness. It has seemed as though there was no time to write. The mornings, if they're sunny, are taken up with sun treatment. The post eats away the afternoon, and at night, I'm tired. But it goes deeper. Yes, you are right. I haven't felt able to yield to the kind of contemplation that is necessary. I haven't felt pure in heart, not humble, not good. There's been a stirring up of sediment. I look at the mountains and I see nothing but mountains. Be frank. I read rubbish. Out of hand? Yes, that describes it. Dissipated, vague, not positive, and above all, above everything, not working as I should be working. Wasting time. Wasting time. The old cry, the first and last cry. Why do ye tarry? Ah, why indeed? My deepest desire is to be a writer, to have a body of work done. And there the work is, there the stories wait for me. Grow tired, wilt, fade, because I will not come. When first they knock, how eager and fresh they are. And I hear and I acknowledge them, and still I go on sitting at the window, playing with the ball of wool. What is to be done? I must make another effort at once. I must begin all over again. I must try and write simply, fully, freely from my heart. Quietly, caring nothing for success or failure, but just going on. But how to resolve, and especially to keep in touch with life, with the sky, this moon, these stars, these cold, candid peaks. During the following summer at Sierre in Switzerland, one could have believed that Catherine Mansfield had finally accomplished the task of inward purification she had set herself, and to me it seems that there is a halcyon clarity and calm diffused through the unfinished stories written there. But she was still secretly dissatisfied with herself and her work, and in the autumn, after a brief return to London, she deliberately decided to risk everything, to abandon the writing that was dearer than all else to her, in order to achieve that newness of heart without which her work and her life seemed to her unprofitable. At the end of October she retired, by herself, to a settlement at Fontainebleau, where she found what she sought. A few days after she had taken this final step, she wrote in a letter, "No treatment on earth is any good to me, really. It's all pretense. M did make me heavier and a trifle stronger, but that was all, if I really face the facts. The miracle never came near happening. It couldn't. And as for my spirit, well, as a result of that life at the Victoria Palace, I stopped being a writer. I have only written long or short scraps since the fly. If I had gone on with my old life, I never would have written again, for I was dying of poverty of life. I wish, when one writes about things, one didn't dramatise them so. I feel awfully happy about all this, and it's all as simple as can be. But in any case, I shan't write any stories for 3 months, and I'll not have a book ready before the spring. It doesn't matter. And again, in reply to a friend who pleaded with her not to abandon writing, she wrote on October 26, "As for writing stories and being true to one's gift, I could not write them if I were not here even. I am at an end of my source for a time. Life has brought me no flow. I want to write, but differently, far more steadily." She believed that she could not express the change that had taken place in her even in letters, though indeed her letters were radiant with happiness. "And yet I realise as I write, all this is no use. An old personality is trying to get back to the outside and observe, and it's not true to the facts at all. What I write seems so petty. In fact, I cannot express myself in writing just now. The old mechanism isn't mine any longer, and I can't control the new. I just have to talk this baby talk. I am not in the mood for books at present," she wrote finally, shortly before Christmas, "though I know that in future I shall want to write them more than anything else. But different books." What those different books would have been, we shall never know. She was seized by a sudden and fatal hemorrhage on the evening of January 9th. She is buried in the communal cemetery of Avon, near Fontainebleau. On her gravestone are inscribed the words of Shakespeare she chose for the title page of Bliss, words which had long been cherished by her and were to prove prophetic. "But I tell you, my lord fool, out of this nettle, danger, we pluck this flower, safety."
I'm John MacDonald and you're in the Hut Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM, and that was LibriVox's Rob Marlin reading the final part of the introductory notes to Catherine Mansfield's last book, A Dove's Nest and Other Stories, as written by her husband John Middleton Murray. You can hear more of LibriVox's audiobooks by checking out their webpage, LibriVox.org. Okay, time for some more music. Let's hear Bernie Brown sing The Bishop and the Tohunga.
Oh, there's a true story that's told to this day of good Bishop Selwyn who lived at the bay. He preached to the Maoris and lured them to church, and the native Tohunga was left in the lurch. This wily old rascal, Tuponga by name, set a trap for the bishop to bring him to shame. He taught some brown maidens to dance in the nude, a wild Maori hula with movements quite rude. He told them the bishop would greet them with glee and give them some kai to take home for their tea. The night it was warm and the moon was just right when Selwyn looked out on a glamorous sight. The maidens were dancing and held out their arms in the hope that the bishop would fall to their charms. Tuponga lay low with a grin on his face as he waited to witness his rival's disgrace. As a ring of brown maidens came wiggling by, he lifted his broom and he fiercely let fly, with squealings and screechings to waken the dead. Right back to the bush then the poor sirens fled. They beat up Tuponga and called him a liar. The very next Sunday went back to the choir. When the good bishop saw them, he said, "Lord, behold thy poor straying lambs have returned to the fold."
And that was Upper Hutt's Bernie Brown. Let's stay in that part of the valley as we hear part six, talking to Trentham resident Marlene Cockcroft on her memories of going to a girls' grammar school in England immediately after the Second World War. So 1948 to 49, now you were in the lower fifth, mm-hmm. you were 14 to 15 years old. Mm-hmm. Actually, there's not much mentioned as far as activities mm-hmm. go in for the lower fifths. And I wonder, is that maybe as a prep year for school certificate things?
Taking it more seriously, yeah, could well be. Mm.
In fact, there's an October meeting of parents for the upper and lower fifths. And I wonder if that was a bit mm-hmm. sort of ramming home to them career focus and yeah. exam preparations and that side of things. What sort of things, studies then? What sort of Shakespeare studies were you doing? Do you remember studying Shakespeare work?
Oh, yes. Every term you had a Shakespeare play to study. Julius Caesar, all the easy ones, really. Macbeth.
Merchant of Venice.
Well, did Macbeth for school, certainly, yes. Merchant of Venice.
How would you learn them?
Well, you study them, the meaning of them, and you write essays on them, and you answer questions on them. And
did you read them in a class and going through?
We all had a copy, yes. Well, sometimes you'd read it going around the class. The odd time, if the teacher was feeling imaginative, you might just sort of enact like a play reading thing of a section of it. But you had to learn passages of it by heart, and you had to learn the meanings, yes. So it was quite in depth. Put me off Shakespeare forever, to be honest, because we, apart from seeing Henry V, we had no visual way of seeing it, whereas nowadays, you know, obviously. So I think to be able to see it and to hear it would mean infinitely more meaningful.
Which is presumably why they did some trips that some girls went on, yes, because that was the only opportunity of actually seeing these things performed and have meaning. In 1948, and we're talking about these years, there was the start of actually the National Health Service, which was in Manchester, and the first mm-hmm. hospital was at Davy Hume. There's a Hume name creeping in there.
Yes, it's a popular one.
What sort of medical care as a girl were you getting then? Who would you go to if you needed medical care?
You'd go to your doctor, and you would pay. And I know my mother told me that, you know, you'd rack a bill up because it was expensive. And when you've got children and they're having diphtheria and you name it, you know, and scarlet fever. And it took years to pay off, you know, what she owed before. So it was a real problem for a lot of people before it became free.
What about the dentist?
The same applies, yes. I had a lot of dental work and it cost a fortune.
Would you have like a school matron or school nurses in case the girls got ill during the day? Was there a sick bay, a sick room?
I think there might have been, but I don't know whether we had a particular, you know, nurse, to be honest. I have no recollection of that.
Would you get injections at school? Like in here in New Zealand, we get sort of the TB we used to at the age of 13. You wouldn't get anything at school?
I have no recollection of that.
1948, in November, was the birth of Prince Charles. Was that sort of anything that came to mind?
Well, it must have been at the time, but I can't remember now.
So things like sex education, how did they tackle that at in the 1940s at girls' school?
Well, they didn't tackle it head on, that's for sure. I think the story that comes to mind was in a biology class with Miss James, I think a Welsh lady, and she was teaching us, obviously, I think about the reproduction of rabbits. And one girl in the class was saying something that all she knew was that, you know, when it was a certain time of the month, you can't play tennis. And this wonderful reply from Miss James was, whoever heard of a rabbit playing tennis? And I just love it. Absolutely love it. And that was the full tour. That was our sex education. We knew rabbits didn't play tennis. It didn't exist. Thank you.
event in 1949. I think apparently there was a Dakota plane on a Belfast to Manchester flight that crashed in the Chew Valley, killing 22 passengers. Any recollections of that?
I haven't. And Chew Valley was where we used to go. Yes, for walks and stuff. Yeah.
Very local.
Yeah.
Well, you just,
I must
maybe
have known at the time. And,
or you were protected by it.
Or did not.
Sort of parental.
Not too graphic. Absolutely. Yeah. You were. Children were, you know, protected more from bad things in those days. You know, knowledge of it, yeah.
So in 1949, that's when clothes rationing actually ended. Right. So it had just kept going up until that point.
Yes.
And also later that year, sweets and chocolate rationing ended.
Oh, what a wonderful day.
So would you take things like sweets to school?
Not if you were wise, you'd hide them well. No, yeah, you hid away when you things like that.
So you wouldn't take lunches, and you'd either go home for lunch or you would, you know, do the school dinners.
Yeah, the school dinners.
You wouldn't take any food in to school at all?
No. I don't remember anybody taking, you know, packed lunch or anything like that.
Sometimes, you know, students give gifts, whether it's chocolates or whatever, to teachers at the end of a term or end of the year. Was that the sort of thing that the girls would do, to acknowledge the teachers at all?
They might have, but I have no recollection of doing that, or anybody not seeing it, no.
Do they organise any sort of parties, you know, organised by the girls for the class, you know, end of school parties, end of term parties? And
not to my recollection, no. Just finished.
Yeah. So your final year, 1949 to 50, you were in the upper fifth, and that was your school certificate sitting year. So you were sort of 15 to 16 years old at the time.
Yeah.
So the subjects you were taking, you were doing English language, you were doing English literature, you did history, French, Latin, maths, geography, scripture, and biology.
Mm-hmm. Well, Latin, it was Miss Levitt. Maths, no, Madame, geography, biology, same as Miss James. Scripture was Miss Pestle. But they're all good teachers, I have to add. I really mean that.
See, you just talked about scripture previously. Now, there was an interesting way that one of the teachers did to keep her cool with some irritating girl at the time, if I recall.
Oh, yes.
NGR.
Yes, that was Miss Pestle. Oh, she was lovely. She would. And
you know the student as well. You can name the student.
Oh, no, it might not have been her. My memory being what it is. But, she, you know, if people were sort of playing up a bit in the class, she would just quietly chalk on the board in big letters, NGR. And after somebody in the class said, "What does that stand for?" And it was, "Never get rattled." Yeah, that stuck with me here. So students were well behaved, really, by modern standards, quite.
And I think in November, the upper fifth went to La Verre at the Palace Theatre in Manchester, or The Miser by Molière.
Oh, yeah.
In December, they went to see a Latin play, The Haunted House, at Manchester University. Sort of in January 1950, on the radio, started up a series, Listen with Mother.
Oh, yes.
Were you a bit too old for that, or would you actually remember listening with Mother in 1950? Because that was your last year at Hume.
I think Listen with Mother is for little children.
Yeah, so you're probably a bit too old for that.
I remember when I was a mother.
You were still listening to that.
Listening with Mother, but no, I wasn't. I was usually prone on the settee while the children were listening.
And in February 1950 was the election of Clement Attlee. There was a lot of... Do you remember at all those times?
Oh, yes.
Because you've been of an age that you would have been a bit more politically aware.
Yes. That was Labour, you know, the big change, yes. All sorts of reforms came in, you know, sort of left-wing reforms.
Mm. And was there much discussion at the school at these sorts of changes?
No, not to my recollection. Again, you know, politics, no religion, really. no talking of money either, too. It was a good school that way. It really was.
In May 1950, there was a week of school inspectors, which is just before public examinations.
Right.
So was there any sort of instructions being given out?
I'm sure there would have been. Everybody on best behaviour and polish your shoes, yeah.
And that was sort of followed by the 25th anniversary of opening the girls' school in 1925 in May. So obviously 1950 was quite significant year for the school.
Mm.
Now, there was another activity about this time that you didn't see in the school's list of events, and that was going to see on the stage.
Oh, yes, Antony and Cleopatra with Olivier and
Vivian
Leigh's wife. And Norman Woolland was another actor, which is it was a bit unfortunate because we hadn't studied the play. And if you don't study Shakespeare, it really is quite hard to follow. Well, at that age, it was. But I certainly, because the only thing I really, really, really remember is, and the teacher who took us said, now, did you notice he forgot his lines, Olivia? And to call for a prompt, he just sort of clapped himself on the thigh, really, and got the prompt. And I look back, what a shame that there's the most famous actor in the world at the time, no question about it. And not so much that he forgot his lines, that's not unusual, but that really didn't understand the play, didn't get the full benefit.
But you do remember going.
Oh, I definitely remember. Oh, yes. And
so obviously that resonated then.
At the time.
He was a huge name.
Oh, huge.
And the two of them were.
Oh, definitely. The most famous acting couple in the world.
Yes, because, the two of them were in Manchester, and they would think they were doing a world tour of either Caesar and Cleopatra or Antony and Cleopatra. Yes. And I think they were alternating between the two.
Yeah.
They started at the Opera House in Manchester in April 1951, and they ended up in New York a year later. Mm-hmm. So you would have left at school at that stage. So that's a bit of a mystery there.
So I have no idea why I was there.
Been pulled back.
But the memory is so strong of that.
And a teacher explaining what happened.
The teacher explaining what happened. Maybe because it was such an important thing that maybe, we were allowed to go, as it were, and invited.
Coming soon to brighten up the theatre on Broadway are two of England's most distinguished actors, Sir Laurence Olivier and his lady, Vivian Leigh. Appearing at London's historic St. James's Theatre in George Bernard Shaw's Caesar and Cleopatra, they have graciously accepted our invitation to give America a preview of their London success.
Very night, you must stand face to face with Caesar in the palace of your fathers.
No, I daren't.
Whatever dread may be in your soul, however terrible Caesar may be to you, you must confront him as a brave woman and a great queen. And you must feel no fear. If your hand shakes, if your voice quavers, then night and death. But if he thinks you worthy to rule, he will set you on the throne by his side and make you the real ruler of Egypt.
No, he will find me out. He will find me out.
He is easily deceived by women. Their eyes dazzle him, but he sees them not as they are, but as he wishes them to appear to him.
Then we will cheat him. I will put on Phidatidita's headdress, and he will think me quite an old woman.
If you do that, he will eat you at one mouthful.
But I will give him a cake with my magic opal and seven hairs of the white cat bacon.
Ah, you are a little fool. He will eat your cake and you too.
Oh, please, I will do whatever you tell me. I will be good. I will be your slave.
Hark.
What was that?
Caesar's voice.
Oh, let us run away. Come, oh, come.
You're safe with me until you stand on your throne to receive Caesar. Now lead me thither.
I will. Come. The gods are angry. Do you feel the earth shaking?
It is the tread of Caesar's legion.
This way, quickly. And let us look for the white cat as we go. It is he that has turned you into a Roman.
Incorrigible. Oh, incorrigible. Away.
I'm John McDonald, and you're in the Hut Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM, and that was Trentham's Marlene Cockcroft talking of her memories of grammar school after the Second World War in Oldham, England. Part 7 plays next week. But sadly, that means it's the end of this week's show. A big thank you to all our guests today, and a big thank you to you for listening to the show and supporting Wellington Access Radio. Now, you can listen again to the show as a podcast on the Hut's Own pages of accessradio.org.nz, or check out my Facebook page for links to some of the individual interviews and stories, and my Facebook name is John McDonald NZ. Join me next Thursday in the Hut's Own show. Until then, keep safe, and let's go out with some more local music. From former Hutt Valley High School student Bruce Aiken, here he is bringing some happiness. Hairi Rā.
She said it's over, understood the guilt. I was consumed with loneliness right up to the hilt. She never really understood. I never really tried to tell her why I felt this way, hidden somewhere deep inside. Wanted this to end the way it has today. Always thought I'd find the sunset, then just ride away. She never really understood. I never cared to tell why I had to leave and pass. I guess it's just as well. I said, I'm obsessed by music and now I must confess. She said, I too have a confession. Well, I'm obsessed with happiness. Happiness. She only had my best at heart. I knew by the look she really had my heart at best, and she let me off the hook. I never really took the time to tell her how I saw the things that mattered most to her. Well, now they matter more. I said, I'm obsessed by music and now I must confess. She said, I have a confession too. Well, I'm obsessed with happiness. Ooh, I'm obsessed with happiness. Once she said it's over, I understood the guilt. I was consumed with loneliness right up to the hilt. She never really understood, and I never really tried to tell her why I felt this way, hidden somewhere deep inside. I said, I'm obsessed with music and now I must confess. She said, I too have a confession. But I said, I'm obsessed by music and now I must confess. She said, I too have a confession. I'm obsessed with happiness. I'm obsessed with happiness. Happiness. happiness.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.